Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. I am Lisa Zambetti and I am the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds and Criminal Minds Beyond Borders. And I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. And with me today is...
I'm Bobby Chacon, retired FBI agent and currently the technical advisor on Criminal Minds Beyond Borders.
I'm Tim Clementi, also a retired FBI agent and a former police officer with the St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department. And I am now a writer on Criminal Minds Beyond Borders.
So that's right, folks. You're not hearing double. I'm not seeing double. This is Tim Clementi, who is Jim Clementi's brother. And he's here today. I'm thrilled. I'm terrified. to have this man in this room with me and get into all of the things that he knows and just let him talk about whatever the hell he wants to talk about. And Bobby's here with me to co-host. Bobby was on our previous episode. He did such a great job that I said, you have to sit with me.
Between me and Tim, that's what you said.
Bobby needs to translate for me sometimes.
You're a little intimidating.
That's the word I was looking for. Anyway, I'm really thrilled to have you here.
It's great to be here. Thank you. Do it.
What do you want to talk about?
Let's talk about the FBI and specifically Criminal Minds Beyond Borders, which is based on an FBI team that goes around the world investigating crimes that involve Americans.
Is this a real team?
It's based on a real thing. There's in the show, it's a profiling unit out of the BAU. And in fact, there's not a separate unit that goes internationally. The BAU, their profilers can go virtually anywhere in the world. The FBI's interests are involved to investigate and to assist in investigations. And to give an example, Bobby and I both spent a lot of time in Iraq. I was there in early 2004, January 2004, when Saddam Hussein had just been captured a few weeks prior. And I went over there with a guy that was only an FBI agent for a couple years at the time, a guy named George Pirro.
I don't know if you know George.
And George was Lebanese by heritage, spoke fluent Arabic. He had been, I think, a Miami PD homicide detective before he came in the bureau. So though he was only an agent for a couple of years, he's typical of an FBI agent in that he had an extensive background and an extensive set of skill sets and life experience that he brought to the bureau. He didn't gain all this experience in the bureau. He brought it to the bureau. So the bureau, knowing he has these skill sets, sends him over to Iraq, and he spends the next 6 months one-on-one in a room with Saddam Hussein.
He did the main interrogation of Saddam.
He is the only human being Saddam Hussein saw every single day for months and months and months. But what George had in his back pocket was a team of two or three profilers from the Behavioral Analysis Unit, the BAU, Quantico. Those agents were there to choreograph every interaction between George Pirro, the FBI agent, and Saddam Hussein, the leader of Iraq, who, by all accounts, killed hundreds of thousands of his own citizens. But it was a totally choreographed session every minute of every day. And it was used to break Saddam down. And so literally, like, the first day, George comes in and introduces himself, and the BAU agents are telling him how to react to everything. And if he says this, do this. If he says this, do that. And they're coaching George. George goes in, starts to introduce himself, and Saddam Hussein gets very uppity and says, I'm the president of Iraq, and I demand... Whoop, George walks out the door, closes the door. It's 24 hours before Saddam Hussein will see another human being again. So George comes back the next day, walks in, and, hi, I'm George Pirro with the FBI, and Saddam Hussein, I think it's by like day three, Saddam's like, please don't leave. Just sit down, talk to me. And the BAU choreographed that. They said they were, it was amazing what they did. And I was talking to George. I wasn't involved in these interrogations. I was working terrorism cases in Iraq at the time, but I saw George almost every day and the BAU guys. And my brother was in the BAU at the time, my brother Jim, the other FBI Clementi. And so seeing the way the BAU was so prominent in this, and how they were, they're thousands of miles away from the round table at Quantico that you see every week on Criminal Minds for the last 11 years. They're internationally. They're over there literally interrogating one of the most wanted men in the world. George was developing all the information, all the evidence against Saddam Hussein that would eventually be used to prosecute him in an Iraqi courtroom. And the reason the FBI was trusted and George Pirro was trusted is he had cultural awareness. He had family from the Arabic world, spoke the language, was a homicide detective. So he had done hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of really harsh interviews and interrogations of suspects that were murderous. Saddam Hussein was exactly that. And so you have the BAU going over, marrying up with George, getting on the ground and doing this. And it was extremely successful. And so I talk about that because that's the FBI working not in Cleveland and not in Chicago and not in New York, but in Baghdad, Iraq. And in fact, we work around the world.
So my dad, I was asking my dad, I said, hey, I'm going to go on the show with this FBI agent who does, you know, international terrorism. And he said, there's no such thing. That's CIA. FBI does not go internationally. And this is the one time in my entire life that I knew something that he did not know. But I'm sure people get confused about that, right? Because we associate the CIA with gaining that kind of intelligence.
I'm still so surprised that we get that question. But we have in almost every embassy around the world, and each year we're adding more. So, yeah, I think
right now the Bureau—
80, 90?
They're like 84 or 86 embassies where the FBI has what's called a legal attaché. And an attaché is somebody that has an official position in an embassy. The legal attaché is because there are the America representative to that foreign country's law enforcement. But what they are is they're there to create a relationship with the authorities in that place, in that city, in that country, and maybe in multiple countries. And as an example, in, I don't know, it was 1998 or 1999, there was an assassination of a Bosnian cabinet official in Bosnia, in Sarajevo, Bosnia. It was a Croatian official. Bosnia-Herzegovina has a three-part government. It's Bosniaks, Croats, and Serbs. Every agency and entity within the government has to have representatives of all three. And so one of these individuals, a cabinet-level official, is killed in his car. There's a bomb placed under the floorboard of his car. There were two mercury switches on the bomb. The Sarajevo is built in a valley, and this is the main drag right down the middle, and that's when the car goes boom, so that the most number of people would see it. And it was a message. It was an assassination, and it happened less than a block from the U.S. Embassy. So the U.S. ambassador happened to come out of the embassy to find out what was going on. Obviously, a big explosion. But what he was most horrified by was coming out onto this crime scene. Here's the bloody victim who's not even dead yet in the car still. The car is destroyed by this explosion. It was a very precise explosion. The driver didn't even get injured. And on the scene are police officers. Sarajevo police officers from the local police force and their federal agencies are all on the scene there. And they're pointing guns at each other. The Croats are pointing at the Serbs saying, you did it. The Serbs are pointing at the Bosniaks saying, you did it. The Bosniaks are pointing at the Croats saying, no, you killed your own guy to make it look like we did it. And literally, there are 50 cops around the victim in his car threatening to kill each other. The U.S. ambassador comes out and sees this is not good. This is a situation where this country could cease to exist on this very day because it could turn into a civil war. And so the U.S. ambassador said, stop, don't let whoever did this destroy your country. And they all turned to the U.S. ambassador and they said, then you solve this. You're an outsider. You don't have a dog in this fight. You do it. So the ambassador's standing there, bunch of cops with their guns pointed next to a bloody car and a guy still in there. He hasn't even been pulled out of the car yet. He calls the director of the FBI, Louis Free, and says, director, I need some people here right now. I had 43 minutes to get from Quantico onto a plane and with six other FBI agents. A team of seven of us were sent there immediately. There was a commercial flight. It got us on the ground quickest, taking a commercial flight. Ordinarily, we would go military if possible. We landed first in Vienna, Austria. And the reason we landed in Vienna is because the legal attaché that handled Sarajevo, Bosnia, we did not have a representative in the embassy there. The closest one was Vienna, Austria.
We have one now. We just didn't have one then.
We didn't at that time. And so this individual was responsible for Sarajevo. So we met him in the airport. Then we flew to Bosnia, got to the airport in Bosnia. We met with the regional security officer from the State Department in a men's room. There was two women on our team and five men, but we all went directly into a men's room in the airport so we could have a private meeting because being a former Soviet republic in the Balkans, security is always an issue. So we want to be able to talk about something. We go into a men's room, we're turning the water on, flushing toilets so we know there's probably no listening devices in the men's room. And also, we did it because the RSO brought guns for us so we could each be armed before we left
the
airport.
That would be the State Department's regional security officer.
Thank you.
So it wasn't a terrorism investigation initially. We didn't know what it was. And ordinarily, the rules on why, when an FBI case will be opened or FBI agents will deploy is when Americans are involved, American officials are involved, or American interests are involved. Now, in this case, what are the American interests? The American interests are the United States ambassador not wanting to have a civil war evolve in front of him in a country that he is there as our chief diplomat. And so what he did was call for the FBI. Louis Free immediately responded. We were on a plane. We were there immediately. And we were there for weeks working this case. And we were working with the Sarajevo police, Bosniaks, Croats, and Serbs every day, working this crime scene, taking the car apart, developing all the evidence we could. And it was an amazing experience. We also had the first day, we got there the same day, and we got there right before nightfall, and we wanted to get pictures of the crime scene because we were going to move the car to the police station. And so we're trying to process the scene. And this isn't like working. I was a cop in St. Louis before. It's a rough town, but it's not Sarajevo, Bosnia, and it's not Sniper Alley. So we're not only in a rough town, in a rough country, but we're in the worst part. Sniper Alley is where people get shot. I don't know if you remember from the 1990s, but there were images on the news every day of women running down the street, running away from sniper shots. It's a hostile environment. I ended up going and talking to one of the CIA guys at the embassy, and you talk about whether the FBI and CIA are over there. So we're there as FBI agents. The CIA knows we're there. We work in cooperation in intelligence collection when we're overseas. But I had to turn to this CIA guy, typical spook in a trench coat and everything else. I didn't know who he was. I just said, hey, I need to get up in the air. I need to get a helicopter and take some photographs of this crime scene. Do we have a helicopter? And this guy steps up in a trench coat and says, just follow me. How you doing? I'm Tim. And he said, I'm Bob. I said, nice to meet you, Bob. We go to a we go to a French Navy or French military base, and we walk in, and Bob all of a sudden is talking perfect French to these French guys. I don't speak a word of French. Un, deux, trois is about as far as I go. Next thing you know, a bunch of French guys come out with cameras, throw me on a helicopter with them, and we fly over there. When we get there, I look down, and they're taking pictures for me. I didn't even have to take pictures. And I look down, and there's 200 Italian soldiers searching the crime scene with our other agents. And this same Bob guy had apparently, right before he helped me, in Italian, spoken to the Italians and said, hey, we need a little help. We need some soldiers here. And got the Italians to send 200 Carabinieri or some of their soldiers to help. So that's the cooperation of the State Department, which the ambassador works for, the CIA, which my man Bob works for, and the FBI in a foreign country where no Americans are being threatened. Right. It's our national interests of security and safety for the people of Bosnia-Herzegovina. And it's a perfect example of how the FBI, wherever they're needed, sends the people that would most beneficially help that situation. And in Baghdad, it was BAU profilers and a two-year new agent from Miami PD formerly. And in this case, it's seven different investigators with different skill sets to go down there and try and investigate.
I think, like we said, we have like 86 now LEGAT offices around the world, and it's always expanding. I mean, ultimately, we probably have an office in every single embassy. Normally, the LEGAT serves two different functions. It will receive leads to run in that country from an investigator like myself. If I'm based in the U.S. and I have a phone number that my bad guy here is calling in a foreign country, the LEGAT, I can send them a lead. They can run to their counterparts in that country and find out who this guy is he's calling. The other one, so that's a reach back. And the other one is reach forward, where they can reach back to the U.S. and pull out assets like Tim's describing and be operationally on the ground. So I was in Athens, Greece for about a year for the Olympics in 2004, the Summer Olympics. So I was arranging for different teams to come over at different times in the lead up to the Olympics to train the Greek authorities in security and counterterrorism, because we had just had Salt Lake 2 years before. Mm-hmm. So now we come the Olympics time, we had 125 FBI agents on the ground in Greece. Right. No one would expect that. So all those people that had come the year previous, over that previous year, had then come to Greece and were just standing by, embedded with their Greek counterparts, just in case something happened.
Mm-hmm. And if I could tell you one quick case that the FBI worked, it's kind of an unusual case, but it shows the reach of the Bureau. In the 1990s, there was a woman killed. She was killed in Brooklyn. She was found dismembered in Brooklyn. And the local police, NYPD, were primarily on the case. They were working it as a homicide. Since it was just a straight homicide, it's not an FBI investigation. But years later, in Montenegro, which is one of the Balkan countries, an FBI agent who was there as an assistant legal attaché, I believe, is in contact with the local authorities, and they reached out to him, and they said, "Hey, Bob," we'll call him Bob just because there's
how come
an easy name.
I've got so many Bobs tonight.
And they said, "Hey, we got a case. Literally, they found a dismembered body in a pond, a woman's body in a pond." And I think this is like 2006 or 2007. And so this FBI agent calls the behavioral analysis unit, and he says, "Hey, we got a body. I don't know what to do with it. I don't know what forensic skills the Montenegrins have, but I'm wondering if you can come here, maybe take a look at the body and see if there's anything you can profile from it about the offender." So two BAU profilers fly to Montenegro, and when they get there, the body is decomposing by this point. And they're not sure what to do, and they're trying to get as much physical evidence as they can off the body, but they're concerned that the Montenegro authorities don't have the capability. So they decide what might be best is if we take the body, fly it back to Quantico, and then in Quantico, we have our forensics experts work with the BAU and try and evaluate the body. So the agent that was first contacted, my man Bob, ends up flying back with the two BAU guys back to Quantico with the body. When they get there, there happens to be a couple of NYPD detectives that are at Quantico training, working on other matters. And the agent that was in Montenegro first starts to explain, "Yeah, I got this case. We brought a body back. We're trying to figure out. We're doing forensics examination now. And the BAU guys are trying to help me figure out the profile on the killer based on how the body was dismembered, based on the behavior that led to this body being discovered." And one of the NYPD cops says, "You know, I picked up a case like 15 years ago that I inherited from another detective when he retired. And he said it was a woman that was dismembered in New York." And so the agent says, "Really, really? You know, tell me about it." And he said, "Well, I really don't really remember that much about it. I just know that we had a suspect that disappeared somewhere." "Where did he disappear?" "Somewhere in the Balkans." And Agent Bob says, "Well, Montenegro's in the Balkans. That's where we got this body." And the detective was like, "Really? Is that true?" "Yeah, okay." He didn't know anything about that part of the world. But the world's much smaller now. The FBI is one of the reasons for it. And so the NYPD detective gets their old files from Brooklyn in early 1990s. And it was about 13 or 14 years prior, maybe 15 at most, that the first body turned up in Brooklyn. And he says, "Well, we had a suspect, but he disappeared. And he's Albanian. I don't know if Albania is anywhere near Montenegro." "Yeah, they're next door neighbors." "Okay, well, this is the guy we were looking at. We thought he might be good for this killing because he knew the victim, but he disappeared before we could do any more investigation on him." And it turns out that guy is now living in Montenegro. So now the FBI jumps in, joins with the NYPD, and they say, "Okay, let's figure out if we can retrace this guy's steps." They find out the guy had lived in Belgium for 5 years. They go to Belgium, and they start looking at cases, and they find there's five unsolved homicides of women who were dismembered in virtually the same way. The Belgians hadn't even considered they had a serial killer, so they hadn't like approached Interpol or the FBI to say, "Does anybody know about cases like this?" And it was just three disparate investigations that all melded together. And so finally, they arrest the Montenegrin authorities, arrest this Albanian guy who's living in Montenegro and now has a Montenegrin passport, so he's a Montenegro citizen. They do not have an extradition treaty with the United States. So Montenegro will not send this guy back to the United States to face trial for the Brooklyn murder, and they won't send him to Belgium to face trial for the Belgian murders. So what the FBI does is they convince the Montenegro authorities to allow the case in Brooklyn to be prosecuted in Montenegro. They create an extraterritorial case. And so they take all the evidence they have on him from the Brooklyn case from 13, 14, 15 years ago, bring it to Montenegro and ask the Montenegro prosecutors to prosecute and now a Montenegrin citizen for a homicide he'd committed 15 years prior in the United States. Based on the profile the BAU had put together, based on the physical evidence the NYPD had collected years prior and based on everything they're able to develop at this time. He's convicted and he's sitting in a Montenegrin prison on this date. And that's the example of, wow, the FBI does that? Yeah. They were asked to help out because they found a body in a pond, and it led to now, and they're still trying to build the case on the Belgian cases and the woman that was found in Montenegro. So this guy might, if he survives the current sentence, be facing six more homicide
trials. That's incredible.
Trials.
And if it was a movie, we wouldn't believe it. I mean, right. It takes
exactly.
Too much to be believed.
People be like, that doesn't really happen.
Yeah. Okay, guys, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about something else. Okay? Okay, and we're back with our conversation with Tim Clementi and Bobby Chacon. On our show, we focus on Americans that are abroad who get into trouble.
So I have a daughter that's living in Europe right now, and it concerns me because Americans are victims of different kinds of crimes around the world. My cases that I worked in the FBI, I was on a reactive squad. And what a reactive squad in the FBI is that you react to a crime and go wherever you need to go. And so our areas of responsibility, I was based in Washington, D.C. Our squad was called the National Capital Response Squad. We were in Washington, which is the nation's capital, hence the name National Capital Response Squad. So we had the fun stuff, the Middle East, Africa, and Europe. And so when an incident would happen, when something would go boom, we would respond. And now some of those incidents were major bombings. The USS Cole was attacked in Aden, Yemen. I was on a plane within a couple hours of that on my way to Yemen. When the U.S. embassies in 1998 were attacked in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, and Nairobi, Kenya, we were on a plane flying over to Africa.
And this is like I said earlier, there's so many different overseas components of the FBI. What Tim is describing now is part of the Rapid Deployment Team program, because they can support this type of activity. And it was if a incident happens in that area of responsibility, as long as the host nation, which our LEAGUE would be responsible for, invites us in, those four officers could deploy their rapid deployment team, which in effect is a mini field office. In theory, what you would do in practice, normally it's some specialized units. It's very tailored to the situation. But in theory, what it would be is you take all of different assets and all the different capabilities of an FBI field office and you transport them to that foreign country.
It depends on what's
tailored.
Needed. So like an incident like the embassy bombings, we sent hundreds of agents over there because we had to work major crime scenes and conduct huge investigations. The evidence alone going through it all takes weeks and weeks and weeks to find and evaluate all that evidence. But other cases like the USS Cole was we were limited to one plane. The first flight was like 62 people total from the State Department, the CIA, and the FBI, and we're all on one plane. And we're figuring out, we're on the tarmac at Andrews Air Force Base, literally trying to figure out how many communications people do we need, how many security people do we need, how many tactical medical, how many weapons of mass destruction, how many evidence techs do we need, how many language people do we need, and putting the right number of bodies on that plane and flying over as quickly as we can. But in other cases, I'll give you an example, like in Kosovo, you had thousands and thousands and thousands of people, victims of genocide in Kosovo. And a couple of our agents went over there and they spent years in Kosovo digging up bodies and identifying them using DNA. They had lines of people waiting weeks and weeks online, Kosovo citizens, coming to give their own DNA and a photograph. This is my brother that's been missing for 7 years.
Mass graves.
Yeah, thousands and thousands of bodies buried. And again, there's no Americans there. There's no American dead bodies. But these agents are there to help the Kosovo people find their lost loved ones and bury them properly. But another case was there was a couple of Americans that were in Uganda in the jungle guerrilla watching, and they disappeared. It turns out they were victims of robbers with machetes. They just got killed in the jungle with machetes, and whatever possessions they had on them were stolen. But they were American citizens, disappear in the jungle. Their family hasn't heard from them for whatever period of time. Got concerned, notifies the U.S. embassy. The embassy tries to get answers. They can't. So the embassy notifies the FBI. And in that case, a husband and wife FBI team were sent over. Tom and Jean, if you're listening. So they go over there and they're working in the jungle, trying to find the remains, identify them, and figure out what happened. So this is just two like basic sightseeing tourists that end up disappearing in a jungle, and things like that happen. People fall victim to all sorts of crimes. And no matter what it is, if the FBI has jurisdiction and if the FBI gets the authority of the U.S. State Department and the host government, then we respond. And sometimes we even respond before we have that authority. It's called country clearance. So the State Department's responsible for authorizing any American assets. So it doesn't matter who you are. If you work for the United States government, you know, we carried tourist passports. I had two different tourist passports in my official bureau name, Timothy Guy Clementi, and also in my undercover name. And then you also carry a brown passport or a maroon passport, which is a United States official passport. That means I'm an official of the United States government. And then we also carried black passports, those of us that worked regularly overseas. And a black passport is a diplomatic passport. And we have all of those because under certain circumstances, you might use a different one. Like going into certain countries in the Middle East, they would say, we're going on tourist passports today. You're not on official business. You don't work for the FBI. You don't mention anything of that. So you use a false business name or whatever for why you're in country or you're on vacation. You're going here because we don't want other intelligence agencies to know we're there or why we're there. Other times they say we're going on maroon, we're going on official passports, and you have all the authorization paperwork and everything else. And some countries they would authorize us to carry guns, some countries they wouldn't. That would generally be something we would debate with the State Department. The ambassador would be the one that would try and argue or allow us to carry guns. And then when we went on diplomatic passports, it was for a certain subset of missions that was required. And to use a diplomatic passport, you have to have the authorization of the State Department. You have to be approved to be traveling as a diplomat because they have to have you listed as a diplomat. I can't just decide, hey, let me try black today, you know, in this country. Right. That gets you jammed up really quickly. So based on whatever kind of case you're working in, what country you're going in, what authorizations you have, the FBI gives us the tools and the assets to be able to get there properly and be as effective as we possibly can be and get out safely and get back home.
So one thing that one of our writers told me about that the public doesn't hear about very often are the kidnappings. When people look at the manifests and they research who's coming on the plane and then they kidnap someone and get paid the ransom and nobody ever hears about it. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Official U.S. policy is we don't pay ransom.
Well,
I mean the families. I don't know.
Well, we can't facilitate.
We can facilitate.
Now we can.
Yeah.
That's new.
Well, we've been doing it for a long time, actually.
But now it's
presidential. In reality, the FBI has, for some period of time, assisted families in negotiating ransoms. And we did it in Iraq in the early parts of the war. Where, you know, somebody's been kidnapped and they're being held. And it's not just in war zones like Iraq. It happens in Western countries. People get targeted. It happens in the more dangerous Far East and in Africa and the Middle East more often. But looking at a manifest.
So it's completely an inside operation. It's not like these people get off the plane and are flashing their cash and then they get kidnapped.
No,
that happens too, but sometimes they're inside jobs.
Some of these are, well, and some of these terrorist organizations in some countries, like Colombia, like FARC, or like Indonesia, they use it as a source of income. That's what they do. That's how they raise funds to buy the weapons or whatever.
Yeah, there's express kidnappings where generally that would be a situation where you get to Bogota and they kidnap you, take you to your ATM. You get the money out of your ATM and they let you go. That's an express kidnapping. And there's for ransom kidnappings where Colombia, the only time I was in Colombia back in the late 90s, it was at a period where 75% of the kidnappings in the world were happening in Colombia.
Really?
Yeah, it was. You were getting kidnapped if you were there. I was there for weeks at a time, and I could not stay in a hotel more than one day. I would have to get up in the morning. The first thing I did was pack my bag, and I had to leave the hotel immediately. Like, I'd get up at dawn and be gone. And the reason for that was, they have, you know, pre-attack surveillance is what bad guys use before they conduct any kind of an attack. I don't care if it's a kidnapping, a homicide, an assassination, doesn't matter what it is. There's always some kind of surveillance. They have to figure out who you are, where you are, and how they can get you. And so to avoid pre-attack surveillance, you have to develop no patterns, no routines. So I'm in this hotel tonight. I go there. I have dinner. Then I go to bed. I wake up early in the morning. I'm gone. And I'm somewhere else on a different side of town getting a completely different hotel, but I don't get it. I don't go from this hotel to another hotel, never. I go, I spend my day doing what I have to do, and I travel with my luggage all day. I travel very lightly. At the end of the day, when I'm either ready for dinner or ready to go to bed, that's when I go to a new hotel. I go in, I pay cash, and this is as an FBI agent I'm having to do this. American citizens don't think that way. So American citizens, they go to the same hotel, they go to the same cafe for breakfast every day, they go to their favorite spot on the beach for lunch.
Not only do they don't think about it, it's very hard for people. We're creatures of habit. That's exactly. What it comes from, that phrase,
and
right?
Comfort. You want to have a home away from home.
How often have you been driving home on your commute and you don't remember the actual drive home because you're doing it so often and we are creatures of habit. We do these things and it's really hard for us to be totally random in our lives because we like routine. We like seeing the same things. It gives us a sense of comfort and stuff. And so the what Tim's describing is very, very difficult for most people to do.
Yeah. And so you're an American businessman working for an oil company.
Yeah. My father-in-law was a very high executive in a business, and they had to do all kinds of things to disrupt that pattern.
Yeah. Right. If they have a good security apparatus in a company, they're going to tell their executives, this is what you have to do. Because the problem is, if you're doing business today in Mexico and you're with a company that has any assets whatsoever, you're a target. You're a very big target.
Oh, yeah.
And so— you know, you have to establish some kind of security protocol when you're in these countries, and that security protocol is going to mean no routines. If you drive from point A to point B, say you have to go to the U.S. Embassy every day, and then you got to go back to, you know, where your company is located. I'll give you an example. There was an American brewery that was considering buying a Mexican brewery. And so a few of their executives at the last minute before the sale was complete— they were doing due diligence from the books, but they wanted to go down there and visit the sites, see the actual brewery, and for themselves, see it before they pulled the trigger and made the actual decision. And so there was a little bit of concern because the Mexican cartels literally controlled that area. The Zetas and other cartels had absolute control. The police, the military had no control over these areas. It was strictly the cartels. So these executives have to go down there, and now they have to realize, okay, guys, it's going to be a miserable trip for you because they got security people they've hired, and the security people, and I was consulting with this company on this, explaining routes had to be evaluated and choke points had to be avoided. So you're trying to figure out if this is the plant I have to go to, where do I want to stay to have the safest route to get there, and what times of day is it safest to go there? Because it's not just the road you're traveling down, but it's the road you're traveling down that the bad guys might use most often. And so from an intelligence standpoint, what a lot of companies do, and there's a lot of private sector companies that do this now, is they evaluate social media and they create false personalities. And they put those false personalities into the internet, into the social media world, and they attract the bad guys. So if you're worried about the Zetas, the Gulf Coast cartel, whoever it is, they will, over a period of weeks and months prior to you needing the intelligence, they will seed the waters. They will put chum out there. They'll put beautiful women on social media, and they will attract these guys. And then these guys will then be hitting on these beautiful women on social media, on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, and they will be bleeding information. They don't realize they're doing it, but they're bragging about what they do. And it's like, they, you know, the girl would say, hey, are you going to come to this club in Tijuana tomorrow night? I'll meet you there. And the guy says, no, I can't be in Tijuana because me and my boys are going to be down here in Ensenada tomorrow night. So now, as an intelligence official, I know that this guy is with the Zetas cartel. I know he's a lieutenant. I know he runs a crew. So if he's down in Ensenada tonight, I know him and his crew are not in Tijuana or they're not on this road. So literally you can establish patterns on the bad guys who think they're just talking to a girl that they're going to hit on tomorrow night at a club. And in reality, they're talking to former FBI agents, former CIA personnel.
Proactive intelligence.
Who are establishing intelligence for an American brewery that's trying to buy a brewery in Mexico so that they can have their executives safely travel from point A to point B and conduct this purchase of a business.
Right. But now you just told the whole world how they do it. So now you got to change what you do.
There's a variety of ways.
They can do all they want to try and change, but... creatures of habit.
Yes. That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Bobby number seven said. Yeah.
We're going to take another quick break, and when we come back, we'll wrap up our discussion with Tim and Bobby. All right. And we're back with my wonderful guests, Tim Clementi and Bobby Chacon. And even during the break, they were telling me all kinds of things that I wish you guys could hear. So go ahead.
Should have been here.
I know. Go ahead.
What do we want to talk about?
Actually, it's pretty serious what you're saying. Tim.
The threats.
Tim takes his gun to church.
Every Sunday.
Yep. And tell me about the threats that you anticipate.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, we were talking about terrorism in a prior discussion here. And one of the worst attacks my Iraqi police friend ever saw was of a Chaldean Catholic church in Baghdad on Christmas Eve. And it was people celebrating, worshiping, you know, one of the holiest, the second holiest day of the year in the Christian calendar, that being Christmas. And it's a, obviously a festive time everywhere in the Western world, except for on this night in Baghdad, because suicide bombers and gunmen came into the church, ended up killing, I think, 72 people, held hostages. The police had to come in and try and rescue people eventually because the suicide bombers started blowing themselves up. And it was a bloody, homicidal horror show. And that's a reality. That may have happened in Baghdad, but it's also happened in Pakistan in dozens of churches. It happens in Nigeria. Boko Haram attacks churches all the time. The fact is that Christian churches are a very big target for radical Islamists. They are, because they are purely the enemy. There is no mitigation of that for them in their way of thinking, in their prehistoric, senseless, homicidal minds of the radical Islamists. There is no reconciling Christianity with their form of Islam. So in the United States, we haven't faced it yet, but it is inevitable. It will happen. So we had a situation not too long ago in South Carolina where that sick, sadistic bastard went in there and killed all those innocent people. That may not have been radical Islamic terrorists that did that, but it was a sick individual whose mindset was just as debased as the radical Islamists are. And I do not believe it will be much longer before we start seeing places of worship being attacked, whether they be moderate mosques within the United States, Christian non-denominational churches, evangelical churches, Catholic churches. It doesn't matter. I do believe that we're going to see houses of worship be attacked, and they will be attacked, and there may be bloodshed. It may be horrible. There have been a couple of incidents where mass shooters came into churches and tried to shoot them up, and some churches have their own security elements. As a matter of fact, I remember an off-duty female officer in one church was able to shoot a gunman before he was able to effectuate his attack. That's why I carry a gun in church every Sunday. I do not go to church without a gun.
And you've had to use it. Decades. You just told me that.
When I was a police officer, on at least two different occasions, I was on duty in church. I was a cop in St. Louis, Missouri, and on Sunday mornings, crime is usually kind of low, and so I would try and go to church when I could on Sunday mornings. There was actually a Catholic church right in my beat, so I'd go down to St. Agatha's Church. I'd generally stand in the back, turn my radio down low so I didn't interrupt everybody. And on two occasions, I had guys come in. One guy was just drunk. The church was right across the street from the Budweiser Brewery. I don't know if he came from there or what, but came in and just started attacking people. Immediately got violent with people. I don't know what was going on, but either way, it wasn't behavior that you'd expect to see at Sunday Mass anywhere. And so I was right there. I was able to grab the guy, get him out of the church. Another time there was an incident where a woman was coming into the church and she was attacked on the steps of the church coming into the church. And I heard the scream. And luckily I was by the back door and I was able to run out and stop her attacker. It was an old lady and she was trying to get into church. And I think he was trying to steal her purse, but he was beating her right on the steps outside the door of the church. So those were two occasions where I happened to be there.
Did you discharge your weapon or did you just threaten them with your weapon?
No. Generally, one of the universal languages around the world, there's the universal language of love. And the other universal language is, when I point a gun at you, you understand everything I'm thinking. And I understand what you're thinking now, too. And generally, it doesn't have to go beyond that. I've actually only had to fire my gun one time when I was a police officer, although I have pointed my gun at people, at adversaries, thousands of times. And in fact, the attacks ended instantly with the pointing of the gun. If I had to shoot them, I would have. I wouldn't wanted to have shoot a guy inside a church, but I certainly would have, because I would much prefer a guilty homicidal or maniacal felon get injured or killed than innocents be killed inside a church. So, you know, the fact is we are going to face this. It's something when we saw what happened in Nice, that's a reality.
Can happen anywhere. That's where I think it's really going to happen for us, if I may opine, that it's going to happen in a shopping mall. It's going to happen in a football stadium.
Well, it's going to happen.
It happened.
Unfortunately, it's
going to
happen. Yeah, it's going to happen in
right,
all
exactly,
those places.
Exactly.
It's going to happen everywhere. And eventually we're going to face it where they will hit multiple targets, and it doesn't have to be a football stadium. It can be a little league game.
That's right.
That, soft
that's
targets
that rips
are soft
at
targets.
Your absolute soul. Yeah.
The fact yeah. is that I mean, some people don't like to hear it, but a good guy with a gun is able to stop these things in many, many cases. And without that, we cannot rely on law enforcement to be there for us. So why do I, as a private citizen, I'm a retired FBI agent, I'm not active duty, I'm not obligated to carry a gun anywhere. But I do it because I feel obligated being in that building with all these other innocent people, that I'm there not only to protect my family who's sitting in the pew with me, but everybody else's family that's in that church. Because if something does happen, I'm going to react and I'm going to go towards that gunfire immediately. And
sure,
I hope
sure.
there are other people that will do the same. But we need more people, and we have many that are willing to do this, because that's what it takes to stop an attack. Something like Nice. You had the individual on a moped or a motorcycle that, I don't know if you saw that in the video, he's riding alongside the truck as the guy's going to barrel
him.
People over. And he ended up getting killed. He ended up getting run over by the truck. Mm-hmm. But he's trying to climb in the driver's door to stop the shooter, and ends up getting knocked down by a pole or something like that, or the curb,
and fell under.
Gets yeah. run over.
Well, yeah, I definitely don't want to get into a gun debate whatsoever. I would trust you with a gun. I would trust you with my children.
You don't trust Bobby?
I would trust Bobby. I would trust Jim. I would trust Laura. But there are so many idiots that I would not want to have a gun. I mean, you can say that you're retired and all that, but you are highly trained. You're
I am,
freaking
but...
sniper. Don't even sit there and say, oh, I'm just a retired
but
old
let me
guy.
Just tell you, I went into the police academy before I was in the FBI. I was in the police, and I went to the police academy, and I was the top shooter from day one all the way through.
See?
As a private citizen.
Well,
so I don't take the opinion that the state needs to verify my capability. I trust the individual. I trust you.
Don't.
To defend yourself and defend your family.
You know
I do.
What? Let me tell you something.
I trust you to drive a truck or a car, and yet that was used to kill 84 people last week.
Let me tell you
so.
Something. I was alone in the house. I must have been like 14 years old, and two men tried to break into the house, right?
And terrifying.
And you know, parents are working late, all that, you know, and my dad comes home and I'm like, oh my god, this happened. You know, he walks me to the clothing closet and takes out a shotgun and he goes, here, this is how you use this, so next time use that. And I'm like, I don't think that this is a good idea. You know,
Think of the alternative.
I have two sisters and a brother, and we were both raised by a NYPD dad. And they, from the time my sister's older, so by the time, since the time I can remember, she knows how to use a revolver. And we always had the availability to protect ourselves in our own home. Mm-hmm. And my dad always made sure we had that ability. And
yeah.
All of my kids.
I can't tell you what age I started at, but as far back as I can remember, We had the ability to protect ourselves in our own home.
Yeah, my kids too. Yeah.
But it's people fear the tool and not the person. And the fact is, no matter what the tool is, and by tool I mean the gun, or in the case of Nice, the truck, that's just the tool. It's the bad guy. It's the mind. It's the criminal mind that is the threat.
Sure.
And so when that criminal mind threatens innocent people, use any method, any means, and any person to stop that criminal mind from executing an act that hurts, maims, kills other people.
I'm more fearful of my sister driving than of her shooting.
So my Italian grandfather used to keep a revolver under his bed, mm-hmm. you know, until my grandmother did laundry and accidentally, like, put it through the washing machine. And from then on, he kept it in the linen closet. At least that's what they told me. Anyway, I don't want to get into a gun thing. We already had this gun discussion on our Facebook page a couple episodes ago.
Let's talk about the news of the day, week, month, and year, and mm-hmm. probably the century and the century to come. And that's violent crime in the form of terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
Seems to be the thing that's really racking the Western Hemisphere right now. Recent attacks in Paris, of course, last year, Belgium in the past several months, and then in the United States with Orlando and San Bernardino. And then, of course, the attack in Nice, France, using a truck and not other weapons of mass destruction. I think what we're looking at is the changing of Western civilization, the changing of the free world. Unfortunately, it's hard to remain free, to maintain the liberties we have, the freedom of movement we have, the freedom of association, when we know that there are people that want to interfere with that by coming in and killing innocent people. It's very, very, very difficult for a society to maintain that liberty while maintaining security against attacks, especially like Nice attack, where a guy drove a truck down a promenade with thousands and thousands of people celebrating Bastille Day in Nice, France, and 88 are killed, or 84, I believe it was, and 202 injured. That's it's a traumatic event for any society, and there's really no way to prevent things like that and allow the events to go on the way they do now.
Exactly. And I think all of us who are parents, we go to sleep at night. It keeps us up. It wakes us up in the middle of the night. Yeah. And when I was in Italy last year with my little boys, taking them back to where, you know, my grandparents were from, it was on my mind constantly. And not knowing, are we safe? Where's the exit? You know, it's just constantly, it's something that follows me around.
Of course. I saw the picture of the father from Texas with his son on the baseball field.
10-year-old boy or whatever.
Unbelievably heart-wrenching to see on a family vacation. They're out for a stroll, and he's with his 10-year-old son, and to see them on the baseball. He was the coach of his little league team and things like that. And horrific, horrific tragedy.
And so it reaches out and it touches people in Texas with an attack in France.
Worldwide.
And yeah, it is. And that's why I'm saying it affects the Western world, because that attack might have been against France on Bastille Day, but it was against the Western world. It was against civilization. Because the enemy in this case, and it is an enemy, and we are at war against this enemy, and finally we're starting on our side to recognize we're at war and to respond with at least the verbiage of it being a war, because they declared war on us long ago. We just didn't recognize it, and we haven't been fighting it as such. We've been fighting skirmishes and small battles and trying to defeat in the war on terror, defeat individual groups or individual people at certain times. But this is an ideology, and the tough thing about fighting an ideology is it's worse than a liquid. It's worse than a gas. It can permeate any boundary and get to an individual that you never expect could be radicalized. I mean, we look at cases in the United States, and we see that this is going to be going on for a very, very long time.
What's going on today, is that different in your experience than what has gone on in the past?
It's a continuation. I know a lot of people like to say that, well, this is in response to, you know, these attacks are in response to us invading Iraq in 2003 or us going to war in Afghanistan. And that's based on absolute ignorance of who the enemy is and what they want and where this enemy evolved from. To say it doesn't have anything to do with Islam is a fallacy. It does. It is not the majority of Muslims, but it is waged by Muslims. They come out of that community. And having been a counterterrorism agent for more than a decade for the FBI, I worked almost exclusively with Muslims around the world. Literally, some of my closest friends, including my best friend and my business partner, are Muslims. I mean, I've been in business with, I've started foundations with, and I work very closely with. I'm the godfather to a little Muslim boy, because my best friend had the boy and he wanted me to be there at the birth. I was in the hospital when the baby was born. I am now the boy's godfather. So this isn't coming out of, you know, the extreme that I hate Islam or I hate Muslims.
Understood.
I don't. I disagree with it theologically because I'm a Catholic. I just happen to disagree with the theology of it. But I don't disagree with the people. I have many, many very close friends. The problem is that the radical Salafist form of Islam, the Salafists are the real extremes, and what they want to do is go back to the olden days. Literally, it refers back and reckons back to the 7th century. That's where they want to be. They believe that all knowledge that was needed to be known was known at that time. And so they believe all of civilization beyond that point, all of civilization is basically amoral because it doesn't come from that foundation. It doesn't end at that point. So radical Islamic beliefs started in the 7th century, and from that evolved the belief that we need to go back in time. We need to go back to the old days, the old ways of life. And what happens is when you have young individuals, let's look at the 9/11 hijackers. You have that group of individuals, most of them from well-to-do or middle-class families. These aren't the poor that are looking for jobs. That's another, you know,
right.
There is a subset of people that are like that, that become radical Islamist terrorists. But I've seen through empirical data from looking at cases over decades that most of these people are fairly well educated and they're brought up in fairly decent homes. I mean, the San Bernardino shooter was not a poor man. He was making $70,000 or $80,000 a year or more, had a degree, working in a professional position for the county health department. This is a guy that's working in an office and decides to kill the people in that office,
including another Muslim. I mean,
yeah,
they don't discriminate.
No, they don't discriminate, because anybody that does not believe in the old way and going back to the old ways is haram. They're verboten.
You know what's interesting, Tim? Do you think that their methods have been increased, or that's helped them to have this new age of technology and internet?
Yeah. I think they've become way more effective at spreading the ideology than we are in fighting it. And that's the problem, is if you look back, let's talk about Boko Haram, another group. It's in Nigeria primarily. It's in Central Africa, Central or West Africa. And Boko Haram literally translates to Western civilization, or Western education is bad. It's like saying living that way, Boko Haram, means it's, again, forbidden. It's bad. It's horrible. And so you saw an incident a couple of years ago where 200 to 300 schoolgirls were kidnapped. Mm-hmm. And they were kidnapped because they were being educated in Western ways. And that's not allowed by Boko Haram. You cannot do it. And so they have to kidnap these girls. Most of them were Christians. Force them to convert to Islam, or kill them, or use them as sex slaves. And to them, using a 12-year-old girl as a sex slave is preferable to her being educated in a school. Now, how do we relate that? How do we take a 21st century mind and evaluate that on a reasonable basis? We can't. You can't debate it. You can't argue with it. You can't say, but wait, look at how she's learning science and math.
You can't try to reason with it.
No, there is no reasoning. Right. And that's the problem, is that a lot of people have tried thinking, if we show them how good we are, they won't hate us anymore. No, they hate us precisely because of that. That's what they hate about us. They don't hate the color of our skin. They don't hate the fact that I go to a Catholic church on Sundays. They hate everything about our civilization because it is not 7th century Islam. That's what people have to realize. The average Muslim, you know, Dr. Zuhdi Jasser is an amazing guy. He's pushing for a reformation of Islam. I mean, just a brilliant man. He realizes what has to happen in Islam to have a reformation, to recognize what the 21st century is, and to also delineate what is Islam today and what was the radical elements' belief that Islam was in the 7th century. Now, I don't know what Muhammad was like in the 7th century. I have no idea. You hear stories, you read about things in the Quran, you read about the Hadith. You can hear interpretations of what might have happened, but it's over 1,300 years ago, so it really doesn't affect me. But to radical Islamists, it was the ideal. That was it. Everything else, everything moving forward from that is bad. And so you have these people that do not want to change our way of life. They want to end it. We cannot exist and have them be happy. It's not possible.
We're talking about radical fundamentalist Islam.
Exactly.
But isn't there a body of Muslims that are moderate or that be reasoned with?
Only talking about the very, very small fringe of radical Salafist Islamic extremists.
Right, but my question is—
I'm not talking about Muslims.
Shouldn't there be an obligation on the moderate Muslims to—because even listening
Absolutely.
To you talk about Islam is an education for me. There are things I didn't even know about before I sat down. I thought I knew a little bit about it. But the majority of the Western world doesn't. And shouldn't there be an obligation to the moderate Muslims to educate us and shun them? And there's more need to be done by that.
That's why I mentioned Dr. Jasser and what he's trying to do. And there's a lot of other people around the world.
I was just going to say there are other people
there
are who
many,
are speaking
many.
Out. They may not have the platforms.
Exactly.
That's a different kettle of worms.
Hey, I have a lot of Muslim friends that never go to the mosque on Fridays for Friday prayers, almost never kneel down in prayer, and definitely not five times a day, but they still consider themselves good Muslims because it's culturally their life and who they are. And that's fine. You know, that's between them and God, whether they're doing it right or not. But the problem is the Salafist radical extremists look at that and say, it's not that you're a good Muslim not practicing. You're a bad human being because you are not dedicating your entire life to the promotion of Islam the way we see it. And so that creates this barrier between the world and this small radical sect, which unfortunately, even if it's only a tiny percentage, let's say 0.5% of Muslims around the world, you're talking about 500,000 people. When that becomes an army fighting Western civilization, it's practically the size of Red China's army, 500,000 people at arms. So what we're facing is trying to delineate them, identify them, and stop them while maintaining our laws and our constitutional protections in the United States and throughout the Western world, which allow you to give hateful speeches. It allows you to have hateful thoughts because we're not mind readers, and we don't ban ways of thinking or ways of talking. And the more radical the speech is, the more politically oriented the speech is, the more it's actually protected by our Constitution. So that's the problem. That's the dilemma for a Western civilization like the United States, because if, in fact, the San Bernardino attackers, the shooters that killed all those people last November or December, if, in fact, they had spoken openly about their plans until they make what's called substantial steps in the furtherance of an actual commission of a crime or a conspiracy to commit a crime, they can say virtually anything they want. They can think anything they want. And we as law enforcement, really can't do anything to stop them.
You see that a lot, or you hear that a lot after some of these incidents. You know, they says, well, why didn't the FBI know? Or why didn't they do anything? They investigated this guy or they investigated that guy. And if you look at a lot of these guys that carry out these crimes, some exceptions, but if you look at them, a lot of times the first crime they commit is carrying out the tremendously horrific act. And exactly. So as Tim said, you know, we don't only protect free speech, but the tenet, the foundation of free speech is defending the person that's going to speak that makes your blood boil and the most, one that you would argue against for the rest of your life. You defending his right to speech is really the foundation of freedom of speech.
Yeah, and they're reacting to the liberties we have, and that's what they hate. Because the inverse of our liberties and freedom are radical Islamist Sharia teachings, where, like Boko Haram, girls can't be educated. Why can't they be educated? Because they should be docile and subservient in their way of thinking. Again, we're talking about a 7th century ideology that I know a lot of people like to blame George W. Bush for having invaded Iraq and that's why we're having terrorist acts. No, it has nothing whatsoever to do with any of that. Go back a few decades and look in 1979 when radical Islamists were taking over in Iran, taking over our embassy. These attacks have been going on for decades. The reason they're increasing in efficacy and increasing in cadence is because they have the greater ability to spread this ideology now.
Internet.
Yeah, the internet is the biggest because you find people like the shooter in Orlando. How is he radicalized? What made him? We may never know. You can go on. You have a laptop open in front of me. You can become radicalized right here looking at that laptop and going online, looking at Anwar al-Awlaki, the American leader of the al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, who has been dead since 2012. But is still radicalizing
right,
people.
Right, they're still watching his...
And his videos will continue to radicalize people because he was so eloquent in his defense of radical Islamic teachings and so adamant in his attacks. He was an American. He's an American citizen.
Yeah.
Was he born and raised here?
Yeah, and then he became the head of al-Qaeda in Yemen.
Well, here's a different part of the question. If you set aside ideology, to me, this nihilism, this need for anarchy... It must have an adrenaline rush. It must give them something else besides this vision.
Well, the promises they get, don't forget, a suicide bomber is promised 72 virgins in eternity. Let me tell you a story. There was research done by one of my best friends, a retired FBI agent, just retired about a year ago this week. My buddy Brian, that ran the International Operations Division, was in Afghanistan for several years. And in Afghanistan, he began a study. And that study was looking at suicide bombers. And what they had was they had captured more than a dozen suicide bombers whose devices had failed or at the last second had been captured before they could go boom or for some reason had hesitated and
lost
didn't blow
nerve.
Themselves up. And so they had a dozen or more of these guys, and then they had several more that were captured before they had gotten to their intended target. So they had a pool of these individuals that they then started to in-depth interview and interrogate. And what they found from those interrogations was if the suicide attacker is more than 20 years old, 21 or above, he was promised the 72 virgins, eternal sex in heaven with young virgins. That's basically what he's promised. If they're 20 or below, they're promised cinnamon buns. Here's the worst part. The families are told you'll be given a payment of $25,000 if you give us your 15-year-old son to blow himself up, or your, you know, your husband or your brother to blow himself up. The family will be given $25,000. When they recovered, when the FBI recovered the money that was given to some of these families of suicide bombers, they found that it was photocopied money, American 20s and 50s and 100s, printed on white paper in black and white ink. It wasn't even green. Didn't look at all like real. I mean, anybody from 100 yards away could tell it was fake, except the poor people in rural Afghanistan that thought they were giving up a son in exchange for, or the son was giving up his life in exchange for prosperity for their loved ones and eternity in heaven with either cinnamon buns or virgins. That's the reality of it. So, again, can you, living in 21st century America, comprehend saying, I will kill myself and kill all those innocent people over there at a shopping mall or at an airport because I know God will love me for killing those and bludgeoning all those innocent people. And he will love me so much for doing that that I will get the cinnamon buns or the virgins or maybe both. Maybe I'll get 70 virgins and 2 cinnamon buns. Maybe there's some combination deal I can get. But just try and wrap your mind around
that you
can't.
In hearing you talk about the ones that they were recruiting out of the fields from these obviously poor families, but earlier we talked about the demographic of the 9/11 bombers being middle class and the San Bernardino bomber attacker having a good job and, you know, and with obviously benefits and a job that a lot of people in this country would like to
have. See, those are self-directed attacks when you have like the 9/11 hijackers, the San Bernardino. You get people that are educated. You convert them.
Right.
Generally, they have a background in the
hard sciences.
Well, that's
exactly what I was going to ask you. So in the spirit of Criminal Minds, is there a profile of a terrorist? And is that profile different from an attacker who, like San Bernardino, is going to go in with a handgun or guns and shoot versus the terrorist that's just going to be directed to strap a suicide vest on and walk in and blow themselves
generally
up?
When you're looking at suicide attacks where they're going to be directed attacks where they're saying, you're going to drive this truck to there, I'll build the bomb for you, I'll do all this. All you got to do is either drive the truck or strap this vest on, go into that meeting, you blow yourself up. The directed attacks are generally people at the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum. The problem is that when we get into the bigger attacks like 9/11, San Bernardino, and others, we look at the recruitment method as being very different. There's usually some form of, well, I don't know the proper term to use, but people that are in a bad place in their life. They're either petty criminals that have had problems or like the guy in Nice whose wife was divorcing him.
Right.
Those are some of the triggers. But what we see a lot as far as the profile of the people is they're usually well-educated, and they're not only educated, but they're educated in the hard sciences. And why is that key? It's key because if you're you're a philosophy major, there is no black and white in philosophy. Everything is gray. It's trying to figure the nuances out. And that, so if you have a PhD in philosophy, you're never going to get real excitable because everything's going to be, well, let me understand what you mean by that. Oh, let's talk about this.
Is it Calvin? Is it Hobbes?
Is it
Kant? Is
exactly.
it Rousseau? Yeah.
And so there's all gray area. That's all there is. Hard sciences, it's black and white. That's it. If you're an engineer, you have an engineering degree, either this formula works or it doesn't work. Either that size of a beam works or it doesn't work.
So once you convince them of one thing, they're going to stick with that.
Yeah, and so with the religious tenets, what they do is they go to these guys because they're well-educated. They're generally at least somewhat successful in a Western way of life. So if you have a degree, a bachelor's, master's, whatever, or you're going to Cambridge like one of the Sarnoff brothers, you know, they were going to great colleges in Massachusetts. If you're attaining that level of success in the Western world, and an education is a level of success— when you're coming from the third world where you don't have the possibility of advanced education, you can't even get past second grade in Afghanistan. There just isn't a school system. So now you're in the United States and you're going to a great school and you're learning and you're really absorbing the Western ways, not only of education, but of life. Making you feel guilty for that is very, very simple. Oh. It's a very quick switch because now I say to you, brother, why have you abandoned Allah? And why have you abandoned the Muslims in the world? Look at what you're doing. You're living with the Western devil.
Mm-hmm.
Muslims are dying every day. I show you two videos online, and now all of a sudden either you're feeling guilty and your conscience is a little bit tweaked or it's not. generally with the guys that are in the black and white world of the hard sciences, their conscience gets tweaked very quickly and they suddenly feel very guilty. And it's a very fast turnaround. It's why we hear so often, you know, he just seemed like a normal guy a couple of weeks ago. All of a sudden he started growing a beard, we're dressing differently. He feels guilty. He's made to feel guilty about this Western way of life.
And that's what happened, I think, in San Bernardino. It seemed to accelerate right at the end. He was working there for 5 years.
Yeah.
But he met her.
Her.
Within a year, he's carrying out this horrendous attack.
Yeah, and she is convincing him. She is probably much more Islamist in her beliefs. And then she's convincing him that, you know, they have a child. They're killing themselves.
I was just going to ask you about that. I mean, that's what just, I could not understand that.
Jim said, you're trying to wrap your 21st century Western brain around.
But even so, it's like, I asked Jim, like, if they know that they're going to do this, why even have a child? And he's like, people.
Camouflage.
They're going to have, they're just living their lives.
I also thought that particular aspect of it could be his appealing to his male ego on, you know, leaving him an heir or something like that. I think it was a female child, but like if he had a male child, you know, because, you know, we know how important the oldest male child is in the Muslim world. And so I thought that was an attempt to give him a child to leave behind, you know, when he's obviously going to become
a martyr. I think it's
more
like the 9/11 hijacker spending months at strip clubs, drinking, doing all the things they were doing because it's camouflage.
Interesting.
All of their beliefs are hidden now from you. When you go to a strip club and you're flying on first class on the airplane every day, you look like you just fit in with the rest of the people here. When you have a wife and a child and you're going to work every day, it's camouflage.
And I think some of his coworkers did say towards the end, he grew out the beard and he was getting – the problem I saw with that is there's some kind of similarity between someone just becoming more devout in their faith of Islam and this guy who was getting radicalized. Some of the accoutrements, some of the surrounding window dressing, if you will,
looks the same. Yeah.
And you don't want to turn your coworker in by saying he's a radical guy because he's just becoming more devout
in
his faith.
That's a really good point. That is a very,
and
very
it's a key
important point.
But what's important about what you just said is don't want to turn your coworker in. But in fact, what people have to understand is if I'm working at the San Bernardino Health Department and I'm sitting next to I'm sitting next to bad guy and I start to feel a little hinky about him, if I dial 911 and say to the police, hey, there's a little something I'm concerned about, or I call the local FBI agents and say, you know, this guy Bobby that's sitting next to me, he grew his beard out, all of a sudden he's dressing real weird and he's trying to convert me, and I just don't feel right about it. I have not put Bobby in prison. I have not indicted Bobby. I have not gotten Bobby executed. What I did was I notified the authorities of something that made me feel uneasy. And the fact is, you will feel uneasy. There are natural human reactions to things like this, stressors that happen in your life, and you should pay attention to them. You know, when you hear the mugging victim saying, you know, I just something about that guy, I didn't feel right. I felt like I should go across the street, but I didn't. And then he mugged me. He raped me. It always happens after the fact where people realize, you know, I felt something in my gut. I felt something weird. Pay attention to that. Because if I go to the FBI and say, hey, is this guy Bobby Chacon, kind of a strange looking dude, just started growing a beard. He's dressing differently. And he's a different personality than he was a week ago. I can't really put my finger on it. Something's different about him. I don't know if he's having marital problems, if he's drinking more, he's doing drugs, whatever it is that concerns me. But here's the thing that concerns me the most. He's talking about Islamic teaching now in a way he never did before. And I'm just concerned. Maybe he is a terrorist. Maybe he's not. Me doing that does not destroy Bobby's life. Me doing that might save Bobby's life. Because the reality is that if I don't do that, and Bobby then goes and shoots up the 7-Eleven across the street and kills 23 people on Saturday night, and I know I felt something and I didn't do anything about it, that's bad. The repercussions to Bobby, if in fact he's not doing anything wrong, are minimal. The FBI is not going to go to NBC News tonight and say, we have a report that Bobby Chacon is a radical Islamist terrorist and we are putting him in prison forever. It's not how it happens. He's not going to be on a plane to Gitmo the next day. It does not work that way. The FBI is very, very restrictive in how they evaluate whether there is even the potential for an investigation. We can't start an investigation on Bobby because of my accusation. The FBI can't start going through his underwear drawer, searching his apartment and listening to his phone calls and everything else because I made that accusation. The FBI has to develop probable cause. They might go and talk to Bobby first, or they might go talk to his wife or other coworkers, and they're going to do it very, very discreetly so that they don't disrupt his life because they don't know that he's a suspect. Until they get enough reasonable information that leads them to believe there's something there, his life is basically unaffected.
I mean, this is the new world we're living in with this whole see something, say something type of mentality, sure. Right? I mean, it's like you don't, you know, in the past, you know, when we were growing up, maybe you didn't take, you weren't as, you know, as definitive as Tim is describing. But nowadays with people walking into a Christmas party and killing their coworkers or a nightclub and killing people, I mean, we're at the point where you got to start erring on the side of caution.
You do.
You know?
I know.
It's like the shooter in Chattanooga, the guy that shot up the recruiting station and killed the Marines at the base. That guy, engineer, had a degree in engineering. As soon as I saw the crime, I was looking at the news, I saw the crime, and I said, he's going to be an engineering student or recently graduated with an engineering degree, and he will have grown a beard in the last month or so and become more religious. News comes out the next day. Sure enough, that's exactly what happened. And I'm not basing that. I'm not being a racist and pointing the finger. I'm saying from the evidence I've seen in my work, this is what we're looking for. And here's the problem. Nobody exists in a vacuum. Even loners don't exist in a vacuum. They have to, you know, there was a guy, I think it was the Orlando shooter or somebody recently who had gone into a gun shop. Oh, no. It was a guy in Virginia who was arrested for attempting to commit a terrorist act. He was arrested before he could do it. He had gone into a gun shop to purchase a gun. The gun shop owner felt hinky about him. And there was something about him. He didn't like the guy's attitude. Something about him alerted the gun shop owner, and he refused to sell him the gun, and the gun shop owner contacted the FBI. The FBI began an investigation, and it turns out the gun shop owner assisted in that investigation, and lo and behold, the guy was trying to get guns and build bombs to commit a terrorist attack. And so that's an individual that some people might say, if it turned out this wasn't a terrorist, somebody might say, well, see, you racist. You see what you did? You went out. First of all, racism can't be applied because we're talking about a religion, not a race. But they would make accusations against this gun store owner. He's doing what has to be done. It's unfortunate. I didn't make these rules. ISIS did. Al-Qaeda did. Anwar al-Awlaki made these rules. They were the ones that decided that Western civilization should be destroyed. And this is a surreptitious army. They are hidden everywhere. Again, when I say everywhere, I don't mean all Muslims. I mean they're hidden everywhere in the world. They're hidden here in San Bernardino, California, Chattanooga, Tennessee. Really? You know, there's no place that we won't find them. The problem is we have to open our eyes and look for them. I'm not saying point the finger at a guy because he has a beard or he's wearing a dish dash. I'm talking about behavior that is abnormal, that is out of the ordinary, that makes you feel like something has happened to this person. If you know them and you see them changing, you are obligated to report that.
You know, I have absolutely no law enforcement cred, but I am an expert at being a human being. So I'm just all I can offer is what I've experienced. And I know, I think we were all in New York on 9/11. Mm-hmm. I know I was. I know you were, Bobby.
I was actually in D.C. Okay. Near the Pentagon.
But I think the thing that shook me the most is when I found out that the hijackers were, like you say, you know, highly educated and everything that you say, that shook me more than the cinnamon bun virgin.
Because you're looking at it and saying, why would a guy that had a good job and a good education do that?
Yeah.
But the other thing I would say is at the same time, I was teaching in New York. I taught acting and I also taught speech to reduce accents. And I had a Muslim student, and this poor kid, you know, he worked the third shift at a Turkish bank. I mean, he was just working so hard. He was going to Columbia, getting his JD in constitutional law because he loved America.
We need
that. He loved the Constitution. And I would meet with him because he had to stand up and recite. Like, he knew the Constitution. He knew better than I did, you know? Mm-hmm. And he had to recite it in front of a big hall, in front of his professors. And I would, like, literally, like, go, drop your jaw, do this. And he would say, oh, Lisa, I hear you when I'm talking in front of my teacher. I hear your voice. And he was just the warmest person. And when I got pregnant by my husband and I couldn't really teach anymore, I was this big out, you know, and he came to me. This guy was poor as a church mouse or a whatever mouse. He handed me
a mosque mouse.
A mosque mouse. Yes, he was, yeah, there you go. And he handed me a $20 bill and he said, I wish it could be more. In my country, in my culture, we honor teachers above all. Like that, you are have the most important job. And I wish I could give, you know, for each of your babies, I wish I could give you more. And I'll just never forget it. He was the hardest working guy during Ramadan. I mean, he was exhausted.
And couldn't drink or eat
couldn't
all
drink
day.
Or eat, and he had to keep going and work with me. And I always think of Ali. And when I had to finally say, you know, I can't teach anymore, I'm like about to give birth. And he just was crestfallen. And I just will never forget him. And when people talk about Muslims and when something terrible happens and it's a Muslim, I just feel for him because I know how people will look at him.
Yeah, well, that's the worst thing about it.
And it's absolutely true. And, you know, you heard Tim describe his best friend as Muslim. And I have a similar experience when I was in Iraq, I had three interpreters and I had a 70-year-old man who left Iraq when Saddam took over, went to Libya and taught English at a Libyan school for 30, 40 years and then came back when it was Saddam was gone. And I would sit in the back of the classroom. I was a lead instructor on a course over there. And he taught me more about the culture and the language and their traditions and customs, some of which were outside of the religion, but it was just the culture of the of the region. And we all have these relationships with Muslim people. And so, you know, when, you know, sometimes we get a bad rap, you know, when we start talking about, you know, putting obligations on certain people and so putting restrictions on certain people. And, the instant blowback is, you know, oh, you can't do this to all. We know better than anybody the good side of Islam. And so when we propose some of this stuff, it doesn't come from that place that somebody opposing us would have it.
Yeah. I mean, the fact is we're not effective in fighting terrorism without the Muslim world. We're not. I mean, I have never worked anywhere. I worked in Bosnia. I worked in East Africa, in Tanzania, Kenya, Somalia. I worked in Iraq. I worked in Yemen. I worked in several other countries, all Muslim countries, working closely with Muslims. And I have very, very close friends from all those places because they're risking their life to help the Western world. You know, their world's being torn apart, but they see ours. And it like my buddy, my best friend, I'm not going to say his name because I can't because it's his life is he's the number one target of ISIS literally in the world.
Oh my gosh.
And the worst attack he ever saw was an attack on a Catholic church, Chaldean Catholic church in Iraq, in Baghdad on Christmas Eve several years ago. And it was the first time I ever heard him cry. And he said, the worst thing is these were purely good people who never did anything. He said, you know, when they blew up Shia mosques, the Shia were blowing up theirs and it was like a civil war. But he said this was purely an attack on absolutely innocent people. And, you know, their happiest time of the year. And he went into that church to try and rescue the people. And there were suicide bombers in there, gunmen. And it was massive bloodshed. And it was the hardest thing for him to face. He had dealt with, I mean, he's killed hundreds of people himself. Right. And he's been on crime scenes with thousands and thousands of dead. But this was the hardest thing in the world for him to see because his whole life growing up, he had never, ever, ever heard of a crime committed by one of these Chaldean Christians there. He said they were just the most peace-loving people in the world, and they were always an example of what the Western world was like to him.
Right.
And it was so tragic and sad for him. And I feel the same way when I look at his world destroyed.
Yeah. Well, I think we got to kind of wrap it up.
Okay.
And there's so many things I could still talk to you about. You guys have to come back.
One of the things you asked about was recommendations.
Yes, we're gonna do that right now. But one of the things I wanted to tell you is that I was so tempted to ask you questions about Jim as a kid. I really want to know all the naughty things he did, but we will save
them
for
the
next
tooth. He threw a globe at me when I was six.
Well, my word.
We call that a geography lesson.
Yeah.
But yes, now it is time for us to do our recommendations. And I am going to recommend a program that is, I believe it's also a charity. And this is the Sierra Club Military Outdoors Program. And this takes military veterans into nature on outdoor expeditions to help them adjust to civilian life and helps many of them diagnosed and undiagnosed with PTSD. And it takes them outdoors, also gives them a different kind of patriotism and protecting natural open spaces within the United States. So full disclosure, my sister works for the Sierra Club, and she sent me this link. It sounds like a really amazing and worthy program, whether to participate in or you can donate to it. So you can check that out on the Sierra Club's website.
Okay. I'd like to, again, push Gary Sinise Foundation. The reason I do is because I've known Gary for many years now, and he's an amazing guy. And what he does and what the foundation does is unparalleled in clearly in the history of Hollywood and the entertainment industry. I mean, Bob Hope was a guy that donated a lot of his time going overseas with the USO and doing things for the troops during the Vietnam War and beyond. But Gary goes way beyond that. Gary's financial commitment to this is incredible. Yeah. His time commitment is ridiculous. This is a guy that literally 50 weeks of the year, he's traveling to do concerts somewhere for the troops or for first responders, or going to build a house for his, you know, a multiple amputee that was injured in one of the wars. He literally knows these people as friends and family. They all know him by name. He's been to their houses. He knows their kids. It's amazing what he does. And if you'll go to the Gary Sinise Foundation website, you can see videos online there. You can go to Ripple, which is a site that Gary's uploaded a lot of his content, his videos and things. And the great thing about Ripple's an app that you can download. And you just all you do is look at videos, look at content of any kind. And by looking at it, it gives the foundation money.
Wow.
And the way it works is it's an ad sharing setup. So Gary Sinise Foundation uses it because you don't have to donate anything. If you're not capable, and I've been there, I mean, I have 9 kids. So a lot of my life, especially when I was working as a cop with 5 or 6 kids at the time, I didn't make enough money to support much charity wise. I just didn't have the capability. The great thing about Ripple is it gives you the ability to just go there, look at a video about Gary Sinise and what his foundation is doing. And by doing that, you've donated to the cause.
That's fantastic.
Literally money goes there. And so, and anyway, if you can contribute more than that with your time, your money, your support in any way, the troops, the first responders all around the world will appreciate it and they will benefit from it.
Cool. Bobby?
As you know, I was involved in establishing the FBI's underwater dive program and the underwater forensic program. I'd like to tell people to look up an organization called Dive Heart. It's adaptive scuba diving. It takes mainly military veterans that have come back from the war, amputees and things like that. It puts them in the water. We put them in scuba diving gear. We get them underwater. Water is a kind of a great equalizer because they're basically weightless and stuff. So, and with a lot of the scuba equipment manufacturers making adaptive things for them, it really is an activity that it opens up a new world to them. I've seen, you know, and it's not only vets. We do it for other people, quadriplegics and paraplegics, and we see them get under the water and kind of float and realize that because you don't need that much mobility underwater to motor yourself around and stuff, and so they learn how to move around in that world and see things that, you know, that many people don't see and stuff. And so Dive Heart Foundation, go to the Dive Heart website and see all the good work they're doing and see if you can help out.
That's amazing. Thank you guys for coming to be with me here while the mom and dad are away and the kid has the keys to the car. So Laura and Jim are still traveling extensively, working on a very important case that I hope they can talk about soon. And we will talk about the next case that the three of us will be tackling. I think you're going to be really excited. But thanks, you guys. I appreciate
you
being here.
Thanks for having us.
So if you like our show and you want to help us out, there are a couple things you can do. First, you can go over to iTunes and leave us a positive 5-star review. You can also like our Facebook page and join in on some great questions, comments, and conversations. We always love to hear from you there. You can follow us on Twitter. You can check out our sponsors. And most importantly, you can share us with friends, family, and anyone you know who's interested in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. Thanks for listening.
For advice or support, if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0207 840 8960 or go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter, safety or counselling, call the Genesis 24-hour hotline 214 946 4357 or go on the website www.genesisshelter.org or you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline on 800 799 7233.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan, engineered by Jacob Moose Molin. Music is composed and performed by Simba Sumba. Logo art by Rob Cohen. Real Crime Profile is produced and recorded at Empire Studios LA by XG Productions. Real Crime Profile is distributed by Wondery.